Good morning. Well, the boys from the Troika were back in town this week for their 12th and final inspection visit before we exit the bailout next month.
So, lads, thanks a million for coming over. Hope you had a nice flight.
Dankeschön.
As you can see, the place is recovering slowly ever since you sorted us out with that field bob.
These cuts have been harsh, Minister. You must have had many riots on the streets.
It's been tough right enough. Over there you can see an angry mob just outside our state broadcaster.
Yes, but why are they holding pictures of a dead cat?
Probably a symbol of the tiger economy or something.
How very creative of them. We are in awe of you, Minister Noonan. You must be so unpopular here with all these cuts.
Well, I'm only concerned with the good of the country, not my popularity.
It is curious, though. The Irish Times seems to love you.
Oh, they do.
Most of the blame goes on the shoulders of this Mr. Riley.
And Labour Party.
Yeah, that's handy, all right.
How is it possible?
The media are so understanding, especially the Irish Times.
Oh, yeah.
If only the Examiner would fall into line more accordingly.
Is you see,
but services are suffering. Our prisons are overcrowded.
Yeah, just like Iceland, I expect.
Well,
full of the bankers and the errant regulators.
I wouldn't like to say anything that might prejudice any trials.
But it's been 5 years already. You can't still be having trials, surely.
They start next year.
No.
Once we finish dealing with those people who haven't paid the telly license. You know.
Wait, so the overdraft facility you requested isn't for paying the prison bills to keep your bankers behind bars?
Oh, no, it's for the bankers, right enough. Most of them retired in their 50s, so the pension payments are massive.
Oh, my God, look over there. A riot. Irish are crazy. They are revolting. It is just like Greece, yeah?
No, they're not protesting about cuts now.
But they are foaming at the mouth.
One man is hitting the other.
No, they're in the queue for the estate agents.
What?
They're trying to buy a semi-D in Dublin 4.
C'est incroyable.
I bid 700 grand.
No, 900 grand. And I'll pay in cash, I will.
1.5 million for the 3 bed in need of refurbishment.
I was here first.
Michael Noonan and his Troika pals heard on Callan's Kicks last night. So after 3 years of austerity and over 30 billion in swinging cuts, it really did feel like the long goodbye. But despite fighting talk from Finance Minister Michael Noonan about our restored reputation and perhaps not really needing the safety net of an overdraft, most people are still wondering if this really is the end of austerity. Trinity Finance Professor Brian Lucy wasn't convinced when he spoke with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday.
Perfectly honest, like a political tail wagging the economic dog. The government, and you can understand why they would want to be able to say we're away clean. The reality is that we're still going to have lots of money that we have to repay. We're still going to have restrictions and retrenchment, austerity, because of the fiscal compact and because of the fact that we're, 120% of debt to GDP, and that has to be paid down. So we're going to have oversight. We're going to have intrusiveness. We've lost our economic sovereignty. Having accepted that, we should perhaps consider whether or not it's not a good idea to have a degree of oversight. The reality is that over the 90 plus years of Irish economic independence, we have to a greater or lesser extent squandered it. And I don't see any reason why we shouldn't be given a bit of oversight.
Brian.
It's taken a couple of generations, if you think of it, and even still it's only grudgingly accepted that we should have equal pay for equal work for women. It's going to take another couple of generations of embedding it into our consciousness that you live within your means.
Professor Brian Lucy of Trinity College. Well, 3 years ago, Paddy Cosgrave and his friends were wondering if they had a future in this country. Then they came up with the idea for the Dublin Web Summit, and from very humble beginnings, it's now blossomed into a major international geek fest. This week, over 10,000 people from 90 countries turned up to the event in the RDS, some of the biggest players from the cutting-edge techie world, armed with fat wallets to mix it with wannabe entrepreneurs. Paddy Cosgrave recalled the early days with Gavin Jennings on Wednesday's Morning Ireland.
3 years ago I was sitting in my kind of student house with two of my friends, David Kelly and Dara Hickey, and I don't think we ever thought for one moment that we'd get off that couch and into any other office, and we've been through two or three offices, and now there's 50 wonderful Irish people working for us, and I think that's a positive thing.
And there were some big-name speakers at the summit, including Elon Musk, who founded PayPal, and there was this advice for smaller startup companies from Tony Fadell, who developed the Apple iPod, and Jay Bregman, founder of the taxi app Halo.
Don't worry so much about the idea. Get the team in place. Get people you work with well, get people who have domain expertise, who are flexible, get them going, and then the idea will come to you. Only by doing that process will you ever actually get to a stage where you have enough headspace to be able to actually do it.
You absolutely need to do.
People sit there and they work on plans overall, but until you actually start implementing and getting in the meat of it, do you actually really learn and find the next step? And frankly, you know, when I was coming up through the ranks and I look at so many different startups here, there are a lot of incredible talented mature leaders of startups. And I think a lot of people who are trying to start up and they just got out of school, they should go work with those people. Mm. They should go work with their heroes so they can learn. Because the first 3-4 years, you're learning so much. You need to get a master's and PhD in how to build a startup. The best way to do that is not in school. You go out and you do it with somebody who already knows how to do it.
Limerick whiz kid Patrick Collison returned home to Ireland from Silicon Valley for the Web Summit. He's just turned 25 and he went from winning the BT Young Scientist to setting up the Stripe company with his brother. It's now valued at a cool $500 million. Patrick was Sean O'Rourke's guest on Thursday.
To youngsters on their midterm break who may be thinking, I'd like to be the next Patrick Collison, or your brother John, what would the advice be?
I guess all the standard things that people say, like follow your dreams and work hard and whatever, you know, they're sort of cliched for a reason. They're true. I think probably the advice I'd give my past self is sort of think carefully about sort of the decisions you make and don't be afraid to be sort of to diverge significantly from sort of the standard path, so long as you've really thought it through and you're convinced that this is a good option.
And I suppose if you're thinking of dropping out of school, it better be a case of dropping into something better.
Well, I think it's totally okay to fail, and that's part of what's so great about Silicon Valley and the US in general, that sort of people are pretty accepting of failure, right? You can drop out of school, you can work on something. It can completely flop and people don't sort of judge you as this failure, right? You get a chance to try again. And I think we've been incredibly lucky that Stripe has gone well so far.
Fail, fail again, fail better. Whizkid Patrick Collison there with Sean O'Rourke. Well, food writer Suzanne Campbell was soaking up the vibes at the summit for Drive Time and she spoke with Mary Wilson.
Beautifully turned out, venture capitalists from really all over the world, from California to India, to guys who are in startups that are literally being hatched in their bedrooms. They have holes in their Converse.
They don't eat, do they?
Well, the thing was, you know, the myth about tech people is that they don't eat, that they live on coffee or crisps, and they're so busy sort of in the zone programming that they don't have time to think about other things. And this is one of the interesting things I learned about them today, that in fact, because they're very well travelled, very well educated, they're very much foodies, and they like and appreciate good food. Now, on the menu today, because this was a Good Food Ireland event, they really decided to come in partnership with the Web Summit and say, look, forget about marketing to people when they're abroad, you know, Irish tourism. They're here. Sell them the stuff. Give them the food. Put it into their hands and they'll eat it and they'll go, wow. And it really does work. So today they all had artisan food, basically, from small producers all over Ireland. So they had things like roast sirloin, and this is really beautiful, from Tom O'Connell's restaurant in Bull's Bridge. The Toonbridge, it's a gorgeous little buffalo mozzarella from Cork, Coolini Knockmore cheese, Ballymaloe relish, Banwillan venison salami. And, you know, you'd also stuff, it was thoughtfully done for people who don't eat pork because it's a very international audience. They had a chickpea casserole for vegans. So these were all offered by Good Food Ireland providers. And this is an organisation of really everything down from restaurants, hotels to food producers. There's 600 businesses in the organisation. And you can't just join up. You have to pass a certain bar.
Well, while all these movers and shakers gathered in Dublin, boosting the economy to the tune of 24 million, there was some embarrassment when many discovered that they couldn't even have a shower in their hotel because of water restrictions. And this just as water metering is being rolled out. In fact, more than 1 million people were without water between 8 o'clock at night and 7 in the morning because of a technical problem at the country's biggest treatment plant in Ballymore Eustace. Pora Caden runs the Camden Kitchen, and the water crisis impacted badly on his business.
Around 7:30 last night, the water changed colour quite dramatically, became a blue, opaque colour, and shortly afterwards we lost water altogether. I suppose the direct implications for this are the fact that the dishwasher won't work, the coffee machines won't work, the toilets don't work. So for trying to run a restaurant, having customers in, we had a group in last night over for the Web Summit of Americans, and we're having to explain to them that we can't make them coffees, and also the other embarrassments that come with it as well.
So it hit you an hour earlier than you thought, so presumably a lot of things were disrupted then as a result.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, we didn't really have, I suppose, sufficient time to prepare for it. As we knew that it was going to go off at 8 o'clock, but sometimes with these things, they may say 8 o'clock, it could be 9 o'clock. I mean, it's been going on, you know, repeatedly over the last couple of years. It's not the first time that we've been hit by it, but it's just that there doesn't seem to be any end to it. Or more importantly for the restaurant business in general, the fact that it goes off at 8 o'clock, that's our busiest time.
And it seems there's no quick fix in sight, as Environment Minister Phil Hogan told Richard Crowley on Thursday's News at 1.
But the problem is an unforeseen technical issue at Ballymore Eustace production plant, where it's not a water quality issue, but it's an issue that engineers haven't seen before or experienced before, and they have to restrict water supply because of the fact that production capacity is down substantially.
Will the problem be fixed by Monday?
Well, that's what the engineers hope, and I've been speaking to them this morning and indeed yesterday, and they hope that they will be in a position to find a solution, and they're getting international expertise to assist them as well because of the nature of the problem that they haven't seen before. Hopefully they will find a solution quickly and be able to reassure customers that production can be restored to its former levels.
So what's going on in our waters? Homegrown engineering expert Conor McCarthy spoke with Christopher McKevitt on yesterday's Morning Ireland.
The fact that international experts are being brought in suggests this problem is indeed very, very serious.
Raw waters can be very complex and very complicated, and they are not always easy to treat. Obviously, this is a situation here at the moment where, despite having years and years of operation of the treatment plant, something fundamental has changed with regard to the characteristics of the raw water, and that's making it very difficult to treat.
Rightly or wrongly, I suppose the common view is we get plenty of rain in Ireland, last few months perhaps not so much, but there is plenty of water arriving into reservoirs, or should be. The job of Ballymore Eustace and other treatment plants is to filter it, clean it and send it on its way, but it's looking an awful lot more complicated than that. Process.
Well, the processes are very complicated, and even we all know rainwater falls continuously here, but I mean that gets away from the fact that the treating of water has always been difficult, and raw waters change throughout the periods of the year. After periods of dry weather followed by heavy rains, they change. They change because of algae blooms, they can change because of underground collapses, and really treating of the raw water can't be taken for granted, and you know, really,
but
we do take it for granted, and we shouldn't.
Yet a facility like Ballymore Eustace, which after all serves a modern European capital and its and the surrounding areas, unable to deal with this sort of situation, does seem a little strange.
Well, I think not being able to deal with the situation is one thing, but in terms of the difficulties it's providing with the capital city, there should be more headroom available, there should be more capacity there. Like, there are issues with water treatment plants around the country all the time, but water treatment plants need to have the extra capacity that they can work their way through these challenges. And like a treatment plant like Ballymore Eustace should have, you know, more than 20% spare capacity, that therefore they could work their way through this issue and there would still be sufficient water for the people of Dublin.
Alice Taylor grew up on a farm without running water, electricity, cars or television, and this was North Cork in the 40s and 50s. But she found success and fame and some riches when she wrote her bestseller To School Through the Fields, celebrating a life of self-sufficiency and neighbourliness. Her latest book focuses on the beauty of nature. It's called The Gift of a Garden.
Did you find it therapeutic and almost like a friend after your husband died?
I did. Yeah. You know, when you're in a bad place and you can't kind of motivate yourself to get going, you'd have to kick yourself in the gate. But once you start digging, there's something in the earth that soothes the spirit and keep going. And then after a couple of hours, you're calm and you're healed. There's healing in the earth. And, you know, I think it's a pity in a way people think of creativity as music and painting and writing. But creativity is gardening and baking and wood turning. It's everything we do that we create from our inner being. And more so gardening because, you know, if you put down bulbs in October and November, which I'll be doing shortly, you put them into the earth and you look at the earth, you wait for the miracle to happen. And it does happen.
We've been through a crash before that, a so-called Celtic tiger. There's probably whole generations who don't know anything about the world you wrote about, To School Through the Fields. Do you think it would be important for them to try and remember it, to know something about it?
I think so, because, you know, when I wrote To School Through the Fields, I was recapturing probably the previous 25 years. Now there's another 25 years. But I think the plus of that world was we recognised the value of people. Community is hugely important. And I think now during the recession, we rediscovered we need each other.
Alice Taylor with Miriam O'Callaghan on Tuesday. Comedian Oliver Callan was also listening to Alice Taylor, and it triggered childhood memories growing up in rural Monaghan.
And my mother was the very same. She wasn't a big book reader, but she got to school through the fields and it was entirely her life. And it was fascinating for us as kids kind of reading about that as well. But she was talking about a kind of a lost world of the 40s and 50s. And I think the 80s, when I grew up as a child, is kind of a lost world as well, because it is pre-internet and everything like that. You talk about festivals and everything happening every day of the week. We had a festival in the 80s, which was making silage. You know, you can make silage of about 30 or 40 acres in probably a few hours nowadays. But back then, it used to take a whole week. You had to get all the neighbours in. There were baked hams and roast beefs and butterfly buns going on for days and days. There were 15 people at the table. You didn't know if they were involved in the silage or not. You had some fellas coming up from the city if they heard there was a feast going on. If you rolled around in enough shite and molasses, you could come in at the table unnoticed. And there was lots of kind of brown and dark coloured jumpers. You know those jumpers they now wear during the 12 pubs of Christmas these days? They were what we wore to school, you know.
Oliver is one of our finest comedians, and he and his multiple personalities, including Charlie Haughey, squared up to the real Mary O'Rourke, who was also a guest on Miriam.
Oliver Cannon is with you. And hello, Oliver, how are you? Are you there?
First of all, good morning to you, Mary. Forgot to credit my brought in Facebook, of course, to Ireland, and Google, and Bono, and you too. I also invented the County of Mayo. That was one of my achievements as well.
And also your achievement of Donald Skehan last week.
Yes, the Donald Keaton Fringe Festival, indeed. Yes, and a fantastic credit. Would you ever stop barking on? You're tiring out the country. You're tiring us all out.
Well, you're tiring us out at 6:30 every Friday evening.
Well, you should be my publicist. Yes. And I have to say, Miriam, there is the darker side, or Charlie, there always was the darker side. And it is very, with Athlone, managed to mention Athlone, the book, Just Mary Amazon. Sure, there might as well just be Mammy the movie as well and just cover the whole lot of it.
Oh, Oliver,
don't forget Albert Reynolds as well. He was there a whole time as well. He was there in 92.
Yeah,
I was there. I loved Charlie. I loved him, a whole lot of him. I was there with Paddy Mayhew and Buttress Galley. I spoke to Larry Goodman, Corsetton. I was friends with them all. They were good times. They were honest and decent times.
We were
polite on the phone. You know, like these Fine Gael, they're not polite on the phone. Andy Kenny can hardly use a phone.
Oh, he can. Hasn't he been tapped by the US or whatever? Or he wishes he was.
If I may interrupt there, actually, yes, I have. There's a file. The CIA have been tapping my phone, Miriam. They managed to hear, listening on two wrong numbers from Chinese takeaways, and Fionnuala inquiring as to whether I had taken her slip this morning. But I will get on with the business of government, the important business such as ringing bells. I'm ringing the bell at the NASDAQ at the Web Summit today. That is what I'm good at, pointing at babies, high-fiving children, photobombing and ringing bells.
A match made in heaven, Mary O'Rourke with Oliver Callan. Well, Dublin streets were thronged with athletes on Bank Holiday Monday for the 34th Dublin City Marathon. Over 14,000 runners, walkers and wheelchair users took part, with Claire Mann, Sean Hare and Dubliner Maria McCambridge winning the men's and women's events, and Paul Hannon taking the honours in the wheelchair race. Well, Greg Allen caught up with Sean and Maria for Drive Time.
To be the first Irishman to win in 20 years is very, very satisfying. It's been 23 weeks of hard training that's paid off, thanks be to God. But no, I'm delighted. Absolutely delighted. Fantastic feeling.
Maria, this feeling must be pretty good.
I'm just so happy. I mean, it's just been a life goal. I mean, to actually win a marathon and to win my home city marathon, I'm just over the moon. I really am.
You won the National Marathon Championship on this course last year. You've won that National Marathon before, but this is the Dublin Marathon win. You're 38. It's a point in your career when you're still running close to your very best.
Yeah, I can retire happy now.
Greg Allen reporting for Drive Time. Well, rock legend Lou Reed was well known for taking a walk on the wild side. He died on Sunday at the age of 71, and he was hugely influential on the music scene for decades as leader of the Velvet Underground. On Monday's Morning Ireland, his friend John Kelly remembered him. He spoke with Christopher McKevitt.
There's a kind of a saying out there in music that, you know, 20,000 bands were formed immediately after the Velvet Underground. So the influence has been enormous. He certainly brightened up the kind of intellect that was involved in songwriting in the pop music sphere anyway. His songs weren't just about cars and girls. He obviously wasn't the only one, I mean, Dylan and so on, but Lou made it dark and made it heavy and started writing about stuff that a lot of people didn't have the nerve to write about and didn't dare to even listen to. So he opened up the dark side He revealed the dark side to a lot of people. The song he just played, for instance, Walk on the Wild Side, I mean, he saw that as each verse being a little short story. But what he wanted to do was to elevate the music and the lyrics in rock music to the level of literature, because that was the background he came from. He told me once, actually, that when he was a student, he used to recite Beckett to himself and act out the parts in his room when he was a student. And I remember once saying to him that it's a song of his called Set the Twilight Reeling. I said, you know, it's a touch of the Yeats about that. And he was, in a very endearing way, very flattered by that. He liked the idea of being seen as a literary kind of a figure.
He was self-confessed in terms of his heavy drinking and also his drug addiction.
Yeah, well, you see, this is the thing. Lou gets a bad rap in terms of, you know, journalists, various memories they have of interviewing him, but they may have interviewed him at a time when he wasn't in the best place. I was lucky enough to know him sort of later in life. I mean, I met Lou in the 80s. I think I even saw Lou ever drink a glass of wine. In fact, I joked with him about this once. The last time he was in Dublin, and we were out for lunch, and he just said, can I have some fish and a little herb, a little olive oil? And I'm thinking, Lou, what's happened to you? You know, you're ordering health food. And those guys used to live on heroin and ice cream, you know, back in the day. You know, the Lou that I knew was someone who was very devoted to yoga, very advanced yoga, actually, martial arts, swimming. he might come as a great disappointment to you, actually, if you expected to find the rock and roll animal.
John Kelly remembering his friend Lou Reed. Well, Lou Reed wrote many powerful songs, including Perfect Day. And there's a big debate about the meaning of the song. Many argue that it's about heroin addiction, but I side with those who believe it's just one of the most beautiful love songs ever written.
Just a perfect day. Drink sangria in the park. And then later, when it gets dark, we go home. Just a perfect day. Feed animals in the zoo. Then later, a movie too, and then home. Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, such a perfect day. A perfect day. Problems all left alone. Weekenders on our own. It's such fun. Just a perfect day. You made me forget myself. I thought I was someone else, someone good. Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, such a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just keep.
One of the great pioneers, Lou Reed, who died on Sunday.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
There was a lot of sadness across the airwaves this week. There were many tributes to Galway hurling star Niall Donoghue, who died tragically and was buried on Monday. And there was much praise for Cloyne hurler Conor Cusack, who wrote a very powerful online blog about his battle with depression. In England, an Irishman who was killed after a tree fell on his car during heavy storms was also remembered. Donald Rahan was only 51 and originally from Waterford. He'd worked as an officer with Harrow Borough Council for nearly 25 years. Well, the leader of the council, Councillor Susan Hall, spoke with Rachel English on Tuesday's Morning Ireland.
By all accounts, he was a very popular man. Will you tell us a little about him?
Oh, gosh. He was everything you would want somebody, a human being, to be. He was kind, he was honest, he was caring. It sounds, you know, all the good words, but that just describes Donal. He would always do anything for anybody in trouble. He was always joking around. I mean, it's an absolute delight to be with and work with and just know, quite frankly.
And I see some of his colleagues quoted this morning as saying that he was very passionate about his job as well.
Oh, God, yes, he was. And he put in extra work. And if ever you wanted anything done, he never minded if it was past his hours or earlier than you'd think. He'd just put his hand to it and he'd do whatever anybody else thought for himself. He often used to go off and do things just to make things better for the residents of Harrow. I mean, he'll be sorely missed by certainly everybody that ever came into contact with him.
What sort of impact has this tragedy had on the council?
It's just devastating because, I mean, yesterday we had a massive amount to do, as you can imagine, with the storm, with well over 100 trees down just in our borough. And normally Donal would have been there in the forefront of it all, you know, making himself busy and checking that the crews were where they should be and just generally rolling his sleeves up and helping. So clearly we had 120 officers out working yesterday and some of them just had to go home. They're absolutely devastated at his loss.
From Tuesday's Morning Ireland. Well, we've all wondered at some stage what we'd do if anything happened to our precious children. Brian O'Shea and his Danish wife Maria have had to come face to face with that reality. Last July, three of their four children were killed in a two-car crash caused by a reckless speeding driver. He torpedoed into the car Maria was driving in Denmark. Brian told Miriam O'Callaghan how their family chose to remember Sarin, aged 11, Saoirse, 9, and 3-year-old Connor at their month's mind, held near his sister's house in Dunbrody, County Wexford.
The month's mind was mentioned to me as something we could do in Ireland to incorporate and to bring all the relatives in and have them with us. So I decided to change the nature of that and instead to do something the kids would have loved. So we asked the younger cousins to make like mock-up Viking boats out of, you know, cartons or whatever it was, and bring them down to Bully Bay. I cut down some trees that, and we brought all the timber down, and we had a bonfire on the beach. We did ask for permission, which Catherine made sure of, and we had some musicians down there also. So we did something we did with the kids a lot in Scandinavia, which is we have campfires and we cook snowball, which is a bread on a stick. And you cook it over the fire and then you put a sausage. So you pull the stick out and you put a sausage into the space that the stick was in. And we had a really lovely afternoon. I had cut down a tree and carved out three long boats, one for each child. And I had filled them with like a wax log, a fire log pieces, and prepared them. We set them alight and we put them out on the water as the sun went down, and we set off some of the Chinese lanterns that float off into the air with messages to the children to tell them how we felt. And just as the sun was going down, three birds flew straight over the bonfire that we had, and it was an amazing experience. And I think I can see the children still now sitting on the cliff overlooking what we were doing, saying, "Nice one, Dada."
Brian O'Shea. And Brian and Maria have now set up a charity in their children's memory, www.threemusketeers.net.au. Well, over on Countrywide, Damien O'Reilly was reporting on the dairy industry in Slovenia. Unlike here, farmers can sell raw, unpasteurised milk directly to the public from vending machines on the side of the road. Damien found one of these milkomats in Ljubljana and he gave it a whirl with the help of Slovenian farming journalist Tatjana Cope.
Well, it is like automat for coffee. So you put coins in and then depending on how much you put in, you get the milk out.
Okay, so will you show me how this actually works?
First, if you don't have your own bottle, you have to buy bottle.
Okay. And that costs 30 cent.
Yes.
So we just press 60 here. So now we have a bottle, and now we're going to fill it with milk. And I have a euro coin here, and I just stick it in. Okay, and then we put our bottle in.
That's right, and now we have to
press start.
And there it goes, Romeo. Yes, it's the milk as you get out of cow.
And there we have it. There's the. Okay, this is a little bit of the. And we close the door. And there you have your bottle of raw milk and your cap, and off you go home with it. Should I chance drinking some?
Well, of course.
It's beautiful and creamy.
Raw milk for sale on the streets of Slovenia. Well, you'd be amazed what you can buy. I tasted freshly squeezed pomegranate juice on the streets of beautiful Istanbul last weekend. Delicious. Mary-Louise O'Donnell recalled the ancient empire of Byzantium when she spoke with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. She was walking Ireland's ancient pilgrim path to Clonmacnoise with writer Darragh MacDonald, whose latest book, Toker, celebrates those magical journeys.
You're in Clonmacnoise, a place with a huge amount of history.
Now, but we turned the corner and what came up was what I thought was like a new Byzantium in the distance. It was just magnificent. Like, it was a ruined city and you could see the tip of the tall towers ahead of you. And on our left was the nun's chapel, Chempelnia Galiach. Now, this means something to you because Galiach means hag or witch. And the church was built by Deir Vorgila, who was the wife of Taig Irlan O'Rourke of Breffni. And she, that femme fatale, that yoke that ran off, was responsible for all of the trouble of Strongbow for 800 years. So you come from a great tradition of religious marauders. The interesting thing was that the church, the monastic church of the nuns, was outside the city, you know, with so near and yet so far. And then I looked up at all this historical grace and silence and beauty and holy sacred ground, and everywhere is the texture of stone and the carved round towers started by St. Kieran and the Romanesque arches and the Celtic crosses and the magnificent cross of the scriptures. And you are in a new civilization and you are in our Camino.
Mary-Louise O'Donnell with Sean O'Rourke. Well, the controversy over the removal of two Roma children from their families in Tala and Athlone on suspicion of abduction, allegations which, by the way, were subsequently found to be false, has focused attention on the lives of the Roma community in Ireland. Well, Brian O'Connell visited some Roma who'd settled in the Orchard Court estate in the suburb of Blackpool in Cork at the end of the 90s. And he first spoke with PhD student Gina Lorden, who moved here from Romania 13 years ago.
They started to travel about 1,000 years ago, and in small kind of pockets or groups, and around the 12th century they arrived in Europe. The largest number of them arrived in Europe through Romania, where they have actually been enslaved for over 500 years. They were sold or exchanged for kettles or other goods. The little Roma girls were actually sold to the landlords for prostitution, and probably this is one of the reasons why early marriage occurs in some of the Roma communities. You know, many of them, you know, resorted to begging on the streets or just as a matter of surviving. Begging is still a future for many families because they have been living in poverty, extreme poverty, ever since 19th century. In most of the European countries, they have been continuously marginalized. They have been subjected to racist attacks.
Brian O'Connell also met a young girl who's second generation Roma.
My name's Patricia Rostas.
And what age are you, Patricia?
I'm 10 years old.
And tell me a bit about yourself.
Well, I live in Ireland. I go to school. I'm very happy with my school. I love my teachers and all my friends are kind to me. My mom is Roma, my dad is Irish, and I'm really proud of my Roma family and my Irish family.
How do you find learning Irish?
I'm very good at Irish.
Are you?
Yeah.
It must make you sad when people say negative things sometimes, does it? Like, it must make, because you're so proud of that part of your family.
Yeah, because I don't like when people, like, if they come up to you and say, oh, I don't like you now because, like, you're from it, you're half a different country and you're just not normal.
So people have been talking about the Roma community a little bit. Yeah. What did you think of that?
Well, I thought it was horrible and shocking.
10-year-old Patricia Rossas from Brian O'Connell's report for the Today Show. Well, Mooney reporter Brenda Donoghue went to Ballymun Flats this week. As you know, a plan to regenerate the area was first hatched in the 90s, and next year the last of the seven tower blocks will be demolished. Only five flats in the James Plunkett Tower remain occupied.
I see a family here coming out of the doors in James Plunkett Towers. Morning.
Good morning.
Do you live here in
My daughter does.
Does she?
Yeah, she's here with five other people. There's only six of them left, you know. Yeah. So I came up to see how she was getting on because she's on the floor there and all the other tenants are gone.
Yeah.
So she's the only one living there on that, and there's an awful lot of the drugs going, and they come in out of the cold into the heat and up onto the landings.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it was only Jade last night, was it? Or the night before? Mm. She had to go out and there was two young fellas sitting down. And she said to them, lads, come on, you have to move. She said, somebody's still living here. They said, we move off now, they said. She said now that she has to wait till after Christmas.
Is she living on her own? Is she with her there?
Yeah. She has her daughter there now, back living with her. Mm. This while now with a baby, Mia. She's three.
Yeah.
But now Lisa, don't get me wrong, she loved the flats, you know what I mean? Loved them because they're lovely and warm and everything, hot water. I was in them myself for 20 years, you know what I mean, before I got my house. She was offered place, but they're very small.
Yeah.
I phoned you wouldn't for into them, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
They're not making them like they did the flat. Them flats is gorgeous now. Yeah. Really are, you know what I mean? Big sitting room, big bedroom. So now what they're making now, the apartments, they're making them too small.
Yeah.
Sure, she wouldn't be able to fit a fridge or nothing into the kitchen, you know what I mean?
Do you worry about her here with the apartments so isolated?
Yeah, isolated. I said to my Lisa, when you go out and they're on the line, just say, guys, could you just not go up to the floor where there's nobody living and do that, what is I doing? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't come out and be throwing and shouting at them because you'd be afraid of what they do.
I know.
You know what I mean? And she is like kind of nervous living there.
It can't come quick enough for you
as a mammy. That's what I said to her. I said, I can't wait for you, to get your new little place. You know what I mean? But at night time, it's packed now with the young fellas, you know what I mean? They're coming out of the cold, you see. There's no concierge there now, so they can just get in and out themselves.
Brenda Donoghue reporting from Ballymun Flats for The Mooney Show.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
Tony Blair's Sultan of Spin, Alistair Campbell, was in town this week for the launch of the latest volume of his diaries. The Irish Diaries, 1994 to 2003, is edited by Cathy Gilfillan and details the tricky negotiations that finally led to the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. And Alistair Campbell was full of admiration for Bertie Ahern's role in the peace process and recalled how the former Taoiseach and Tony Blair had worked so well together.
The very first meeting as Taoiseach and Prime Minister was in, I think, July of 97. And Tony Blair came away as feeling that Bertie Ahern was basically putting the Sinn Féin line most of the time in contrast to his predecessor, John Bruton. Did that remain your view or his view?
No, it's interesting. When I was transcribing my diaries, because I do like Bertie Ahern so much and because I do think he did such a great job, I was surprised that that was our first impression. Because actually, as we went through the thing, Tony and Bertie did develop this really kind of close synergy. So the first impression there clearly was that we thought he was going to be difficult because he'd only see one side of the equation. But actually one of his great strengths was that he didn't just see one side of the equation. And if you remember, Tony's first important speech as Prime Minister, really important speech, was the one that he made in Belfast where he set out the strategic framework for the whole peace process. And Bertie was a part of that.
And again, you go into detail about how at one stage, after the Good Friday Agreement, after OMA, the thing had hit a bit of a logjam, and Tony Blair, cut loose. I mean, there was none of the charm, there was none of the cajoling. It was steel, and he talked about not being a relate councillor.
He did, although if you read the introduction to the book, a lot of the time he was like a relate councillor. But he said, and I think that was his strength in this whole thing, is that sometimes people would often say, the media would say, why don't you these just guys get them in a room and sort this out? But actually, sometimes getting them in the room together would be the worst thing to do. The best thing to do was for somebody to And Tony talks in the introduction about absorbing their pain and feeling their anger and genuinely feeling it. And sometimes we would honestly put our head in our hands and say, can this flag thing matter so much? Does this parade thing really matter so much? But the fact is that it did matter. And therefore you had to address it from that perspective. This really matters. You have to understand why.
And Alistair was also very complimentary about the Sinn Féin delegation.
I was surprised by the extent to which I liked the Sinn Féin guys, and I really did like McGuinness. I felt there was something about him that was direct, and he had a certain charm as well. Now, I know I can imagine there are people who will say, how can you say that about somebody who's been involved in the things that they were involved in and so forth, but the thing about writing a diary is you're speaking as you find.
Was there a bit of the New Labour man in you writing that when you say, look, at least they all stayed on message, you knew that they had a position they agreed when they came into the room and they stuck to it?
Well, there's a bit where I say that one of the things I like about McGuinness is that he makes a point and then he batters it. And that, I guess, is how I used to communicate a little bit as well. You make a point and then you batter it. And what that means is that you make the point until people have got it. They understand what you're saying. And I did, maybe there was something in that, that what was frustrating sometimes about the unionists, as I say, is you saw the divisions on display. And maybe I did have a bit of an admiration for the way these Sinn Féin guys came in, and they operated like a team. It was like watching a rugby team. I mean, even the way that they stood behind the microphone when there were Adams
they
or McGuinness.
They probably learned it from you.
Well, they may have learned some of it, although interestingly, I could never quite work out why, but McGuinness always had a feeling that I was up to something and that was different to what Tony was up to. And I never was. I never did anything that Tony didn't want done. And yet he was always saying, there were various points at which Tony will say something and then Martin McGuinness says, yeah, but what's he say about that? And I was genuinely baffled by that because I never had my own agenda on this. I was totally pursuing Tony Blair's agenda.
Alistair Campbell with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. Singer-songwriter Dolly Parton grew up in the Smoky Mountains of East Tennessee, one of a family of 12, in very humble circumstances.
Just country folks making a living up there on a little old 40-acre farm. My dad scratched out a living. We grew all of our own food, and we had a good life then. It was a hard one, harder for my mom and dad than for us. They made things as easy for us as they could, but I have some wonderful memories. It's given me some wonderful ideas for songs and all that heart and soul of, you know, clinging together as family, believing and clinging to God and trusting one another and trusting God, and that's how you get through, and that's how I keep my sanity now when it gets so bad, you know, out in the crazy world. All I have to do is close my eyes and go home or pick up my guitar and sing one of those songs I've written about home.
You kind of knew you'd be a star.
Well, I wanted to be. I always wanted to be a singer. I wanted to travel. I wanted to see what was beyond the Smoky Mountains. So I guess I kind of did always feel like that I was going to be doing what I'm doing now. Of course, when you dream, sometimes your dreams come true. Sometimes they come false as well. But mine did come true. And I'm so thankful and so happy that I got to enjoy my life making a living at what I dreamed of and what I really love to do, and that's making music.
You've got that focus and confidence. Did you always have that from a young age? And did you get that from your upbringing in Tennessee?
Well, I think my faith in God was always very strong, and I just believed, like they always said, that through God all things are possible. And so I just kind of clung to that scripture. My grandpa was a preacher. My mother was very spiritual, and my mother allowed us to be our own selves, you know, what she encouraged us to do, whatever we wanted to do. My mother's people were very musical, so I just took that and went farther with it than any of them had. They usually performed around at local stuff in churches and county fairs, that sort of thing. But I just thought, well, I saw early on that I might be able to make that into a business. And so it was my dream. It was my love. And I think God was in it, and evidently he was, because he's been good to me, and hopefully I've been able to touch people. My greatest wish in this world has always been to entertain and to uplift people.
Dolly is also a kind of fairy godmother to Miley Cyrus. Miley, as you know, has been in a bit of hot water recently because of her twerking episode, but Dolly is slow to give advice.
I love her to death. I know she's made some extreme moves. I think she had to prove her point. And you'll never hear me say anything bad about Miley. I just wish her the best. I think she's trying very hard to make her spot. She's made her point. She's found her place, and more power to her. She's a great writer, great singer, and I hope people will leave her alone now and let her go on with her life and do her music the way she wants to, and hopefully she'll make wise choices. I think she had to do some desperate things now, so hopefully she can pull back into that and, you know, just really enjoy her music.
Would you ever give her advice, Dolly? And do you think it's more difficult for a young woman like her in the music business today than when you started out?
Well, I don't give people advice. I never wanted advice myself. I just want information. Molly doesn't need my advice. She's doing all right on her own. I love her. And I just hope she does great.
Dolly Parton with Miriam O'Callaghan. Well, Dolly has written some brilliant songs. My current favourite is Backwoods Barbie. But I leave you now with one of her finest, Jolene. Gormaw gavas for golúther, tasulam gorwanshiv, saltas aglar, agus gmeshivlam, takan amikena, an tachtan chahagin, gaji shin, gaji shibslan.
Beyond compare, with flaming locks of auburn hair, with ivory skin and eyes of emerald green. Your smile is like a breath of spring, your voice is soft like summer rain, and I cannot compete with you, Jolene. He talks about you in his sleep, and there's nothing I can do to keep from crying when he calls your name, Jolene. Understand how you could easily take my man, but you don't know what he means.